results. It's not like we can do one study and look at all aspects of gut health. I think that's unrealistic at this time. But we will be working in the fields we're in to try to put our studies into more clearly what aspects of gut health we're working on.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes, and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics. We're a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. In our podcast, you'll hear about emerging topics across the fields of biotic substances and microbiome science. I hope you enjoy this episode with your host from the ISAP Board of Directors, Professor Daniel Tancredi.
Good morning, everyone. I'm Daniel Tancredi, and today we're excited to have two fellow board members from ISAP who were instrumental in convening a panel and leading a paper that provides a consensus definition of gut health. So we have Professor Maria Marco with us and Professor Eamon Quigley. Maria, can we start with what is the consensus definition that your group developed?
Sure. Our definition of gut health is a state of normal gastrointestinal function without active gastrointestinal disease or gut-related symptoms that affect quality of life.
So that seems like a fairly reasonable definition. Why was now the time to try to convene to develop a consensus definition?
Yeah, thanks for that question, Darren. It's a good one. I would say now is the time because of the emerging science and discussion in the medical fields about this topic. And for myself, how this whole idea came about was I was looking at the literature with my graduate student on fermented dairy foods, and we were asked to look at the literature with regard to gut health. And we learned really quickly that it was really hard to decide which studies to include. Where do we end?
Yes.
On mood, on immune function, or just focusing on gut symptoms like constipation or acid reflux. And so that led to conversations with other experts in the field, other microbiologists like myself, and we realized that we weren't talking about the same things. And why ISAP was the other question that we came to in this whole conversation is that actually the term gut health has been used for many years in relation to prebiotics and probiotics. So it seemed like ISAP was the right place to address this issue.
I'm glad that we have Eamon here because depending on who you're talking to, what they mean by the gut can mean different things. So when you hear the word gut, Eamon, what are you thinking as far as the GI tract is concerned?
Believe it or not, this was a point of considerable discussion. So, because there are alternative phrases, you could say digestive health or gut health. You know, so for us, the gut meant everything from the mouth to the anus and everything in between. So we took a fairly broad view of gut health. Now, obviously, we looked at some things in more detail than others. And just as Maria said, a lot of the impetus from this came from the fact that there are a lot of statements out there. There's a lot of usage of this term, not necessarily appropriately. And when you get on the internet or on social media, it's all over the place. And it's used inappropriately to say that, you know, X product restores gut health or X product boosts gut health. And without anybody knowing what they're talking about, basically. So it was used as kind of a catch-all phrase for goodness and well-being without anybody sitting down and saying, you know, what does this actually mean? And that's really the impetus behind all of this. And as we discovered, it's not easy.
Yes. So we had an original definition, or at least Stephen Bischoff, and his team had developed a group, and that did put forward the concept of well-being. Like, yeah. Health isn't just the absence of disease, it's also well-being. But can you talk about how the new definition kind of gets at aspects of the important functions that are in play, and also how it brings in the patient's experience?
Yeah. So the way this was done is that we had a panel meeting and for a whole day in London, actually for more than that, because we met the evening before, we met for a whole day in London. And prior to that, we had actually deliberately invited various people based on their areas of expertise. And that actually seemed to have worked out pretty well as we expected. So we had the areas we looked at were gut physiology, microbiome, immune system, the epithelium or gut barrier, whatever you want to call it, and the gut endocrine function. So we tried to approach this, I suppose, from two aspects. One is, you know, what are the things that could contribute physiologically or biologically to gut health? And allied to that, as you see that in the paper, we then looked at, for each of those areas, what can we measure that actually might be useful as an indicator of gut health? And that actually is not easy. And we discovered that there were, yes, there were tests out there, but either they'd not been validated adequately, or they were largely related to a very much research scenario, or they'd actually, the data was basically mostly based on animal studies. So I think that was a challenging area. And I think Marie would agree that in terms of the shaping of the paper, which took another year virtually, a lot of the to and fro and back and forth related to really getting consensus on those particular areas. And we did eventually, but that was not easy.
Maria, have you had an occasion to lead a research project, or have one of your colleagues lead a research project and try to apply the new definition of gut health to see if it could help limit the scope of what papers to include or what prior research to cite?
Well, we're certainly thinking about it. And what we hope this paper and this concept sheds light on and leads to will be more structured approaches in clinical studies, in fundamental research, that delineate which aspect of gut health is being examined. Because there are, you know, six domains that we identify, and very, you know, elaborate kinds of work that needs to be done to advance each of these domains. As Eamon nicely pointed out, we don't have good metrics. It's not like we can do one study and look at all aspects of gut health. I think that's unrealistic at this time. But we will be working in the fields we're in to try to put our studies into more clearly what aspects of gut health we're working on. The microbiome, for example, is one that has garnered a lot of attention on this topic. And it's sometimes thought of being synonymous with gut health. Of course, it's an important domain. We recognize that, but it is not the only domain. It's not the only functional component of our gastrointestinal tract. And moreover, how do we determine what is a healthy microbiome? So we had a lot of active discussion on these topics.
Maria, you bring up two very interesting aspects of the definition. One are the six functional domains themselves, but also the metrics. And so you guys have a very thoughtful, you've laid out some of the metrics that can be used. In particular with the gut microbiome, there's still difficulty with what's an appropriate metric. But what I would like you guys to do is tell us about the six domains. So we can start with Maria. You've already mentioned the gut microbiome. What's another one of the functional domains you'd like to mention? We'll alternate between you.
I guess I'll mention the intestinal barrier and barrier function. And it was important for us to explain that there's, you know, this concept of leaky gut can be very misleading. And this is something Eamon is common and also about, probably come back to. But just to lay out, what do we know? And, you know, in a very condensed way, it's and the importance, for example, of the epithelial barrier of our intestinal lining, without stating it's really, of course, very important. But the test we have to actually measure that in with people is you know, quite limited. You know, what we can do, especially in a relatively rapid way. So yeah, that's one.
You're doing amazing work with gut barrier and seeing like how sauerkraut affects that and how other, you know, ferments may affect that. And so just to, in terms of how we would apply it to the gut barrier function, we don't know if the gut barrier is not intact, what happens when you apply what could be a beneficial intervention.
Yeah, I think it's still early days. There's been some association of looking at, you know, the integrity or the, not integrity, but so much as how is it an indicator of dysfunction in the GI tract of individuals who are, you know, overweight or not overtly with IBD and those GI diseases where there's clear indication or evidence of a disrupted barrier? It's not used as a metric, we would say, these days in clinical settings for healthy people. So there's interest in it. I think it's important that we point it out. It's obviously an important domain of the GI tract. And I think a lot of what we're concluding in this paper, you know, and it's probably no surprise to you, Dan, is that we need more fundamental research. We need more clinical research on these various emerging views of gut health.
Yeah. Well, we'll get back to the domains. But the reason why I mentioned that is that the comprehensive framework that you guys have developed is amazing. Like, it lays out what are the relevant domains and then what are the other determinants and considerations. Eamon, or which of the domains would you like to mention?
Well, I've started to start with the one that I was most directly involved in, which was the GI physiology one.
Yes.
Which I guess in some ways was probably the most straightforward in that it's probably it's been researched for the longest. Like, GI physiology has been out there for over a century. And I focus particularly on, or say we focus particularly on two aspects which are very relevant to gut health, namely intestinal secretions and motility. And the problem with both of those domains is that while we do have normal ranges and we do have techniques to measure them, they tend to be invasive. And you don't want to go around doing invasive sampling of gut contents or doing manometry of the small intestine every day. You're not going to be able to do that. So I think what we focused on in terms of metrics were, are there, say, symptom surrogates which give you a rough idea? And that's particularly relevant, say, for example, talking about colon function, because we have at the Bristol Stool Scale, we have symptoms like complete spontaneous bowel movements, which do provide a reasonable correlation with function. So I think they're probably quite useful outcomes. When it comes to the upper GI tract, again, we have some techniques which are fairly widely available, but to greater or lesser extent, maybe more invasive. So I think while that's an area that's very well defined in terms of our knowledge of the physiology, it's very well defined in terms of normal ranges, we still have limitations in terms of how we can measure outcomes, meaningful outcomes that correlate with gut health. And actually, that's another point I think that we would make in general, is that the correlations between symptoms and a lot of these metrics in any of these domains are not great.
Right.
You know, just certainly in the domain we're talking about now, one of the reasons for that is that the normal ranges are considerable, and they're also affected, as Maria was just talking about the microbiome, you know, they're affected by cultural factors, dietary factors, etc. So they're very important confounders there. And we actually discussed that in quite a bit of detail, particularly when you come to symptoms. You know, what is a symptom? Or should I say, when is a symptom significant? When does it mean something? And I think that's why we put such emphasis on the quality of life aspect, because I think for me as a clinician and looking at the clinical literature, when a symptom is important is when it interferes with your life.
It's either the patient experience or what you as a physician would say, hey, you may not be feeling symptoms right now, but this is an important condition, like high blood pressure or something.
Right.
You mentioned, you know, like a key aspect of digestive physiology or the, you know, the absorption, the provision of like the biliary acids. I was sort of wondering, is the biliary tract part of the gut in your definition? I guess I don't think it would be, but I'm not
sure. Yeah, well, see, the problem there is then you get into liver.
Right.
And you really guess. Now, we do address bile acids as a potential metric for in terms of in relation to physiology and in relation to other areas. But really, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. So
right.
I think and liver health is such an enormous issue in itself, and that's so closely integrated with, you know, bile production, bile flow, et cetera, that I think that would have been a bridge too far for us.
Yeah, so that's, I agree. And you have to draw the line somewhere. So speaking of drawing the line, gut-brain axis is another domain. Is there anything you'd like us to know about that particular domain in terms of measurement?
I'll have a shot at that. So I think including that was very deliberate. And the reason was deliberate is because how symptoms are appreciated is very much dependent on the central nervous system. In fact, at the moment for my sins, I'm writing a review on this. And, you know, everybody has rumblings and gurglings and various other things. For most of us, they don't enter consciousness, but for some people, they do. And they become uncomfortable, they become distressing. And that's all, as far as we know, that's all happening in the brain. It's not happening in the gut. The same signal is going up, but it's being interpreted differently. So not to include the gut-brain axis, I think, would have been a big mistake, because we would have been omitting a dimension of gut health, which is very important. And similarly, you know, we all know what happens when we're stressed. You know, we can get diarrhea, we can be nauseated, etc. So ignoring that component would have been a mistake, I think. But it does open a little bit of a Pandora's box. And this is something we discussed a lot. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if somebody gets migraine after they eat, is that a part of gut health?
Right.
And so there are some limitations there to the scope of our definition, which we may want to really look at in the future.
Maria, let's talk about immune function. That's another domain. And, you know, with the barrier function, done a lot of amazing research on. Is there anything you'd like to add with regard to, you know, the metrics we have for immune function or how that plays in? It's more than just the barrier integrity.
Yeah. So as Eamon pointed out, that the gold standard for looking at immune response in the intestine is through histological analysis, so invasive measures. We have other cytokines and indicators of immune function. And then we also, you know, they're not as, they're kind of indicative rather than showing directly for, you know, except for cases of active gastrointestinal disease, where that's been more extensively studied. We did look at immune tolerance as an important function of the immune system in the gastrointestinal tract and the effect of pathogens. But I wanted to also kind of point out at this time that what we're presenting here was really, you know, phenomenal contributions of all of our panelists.
Yes.
So we wanted to be sure to have immunologists, experts in gut-brain axis, gut microbiome, and so on in our panel. And that the manuscript, the paper that we have is really this consolidated effort of this group and their years of experience, including in Stefan Bischoff, yep. who wrote that first definition of gut health back in 2011. So we wanted to make sure we have a full panel of experts. We know there's going to be other views, and we couldn't include everybody, of course, in this work.
But can you talk about that? Because I think of you as like an expert in developing these cross-disciplinary collaborations. You developed an amazing course here at UC Davis involving a humanistic perspective, you know, combining it with the STEM perspective. Can you talk about what was that discussion like? Like, I know you had a lot of physicians there, and you also had like microbiologists and you know, basic scientists. What was your sense about the forum, and what was there a lot of emphasis on clinical aspects and what mattered to patients and clinicians, and what was it like to talk to, you know, as a basic science, as a microbiologist?
Yeah, really the success of these panels that ISAP holds is just the willingness and excitement of the experts. They say yes.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing, showing the value of ISAP and the standing in the field is for people to dedicate their valuable time to do this sort of work always impresses me. And then with regard to the balance of the panel, indeed, it was several physicians, pediatricians, general practitioner, gastroenterologists, like Eamon, vital. We couldn't have had this board, this panel without it. So,
and Eamon, I don't want to, yes, I appreciate that physician scientists like Eamon are also do a lot of important basic science.
Can I just jump in here?
Yes.
I think it's fair to say that when we launched this idea and when we invited the experts, by the way, none of which turned us down, there was quite a degree of skepticism that we could make this happen.
Yes.
And I think when we sat down in London to start this discussion, I wouldn't say there was an air of confidence or enthusiasm in the room. But it was interesting that as the process proceeded, people became more engaged and became more enthusiastic, and they began to see what we were aiming for. Because I think, you know, like the concept of gut health itself, it was kind of vague.
Right.
So I think people are saying, you know, what are you trying to do? And this could be coming from, you know, a clinician. This could be coming from a basic scientist. But I think eventually we all kind of got it, and we agreed on a format. And I think the discussion was fantastic, by the way. And it came from every angle. Now, we were very fortunate, I think, in that the panel we selected were on the science side, were scientists who were very used to working with clinicians and who had a lot of, you had actually been involved in clinical studies themselves. And on the clinician side, you had people who actually were engaged in clinical research in collaboration with scientists. So that part was, to me at least, was never an issue. This was a group who, regardless of where they were coming from, bought into the concept fairly quickly, but importantly, came from a position of skepticism. And I think that was very important and very positive. And, you know, they went from saying, you know, what does this mean? I think it's impossible. We can't do anything, to eventually actually buying into and all agreeing with the definition and with the manuscript that has emanated from it.
Yeah, I think it's a very valuable manuscript because it lays out the functional domains that are relevant and what the limitations of our current approaches are, and also what is available for measuring those current approaches. But it also provides a comprehensive framework that's sufficiently robust that that it can be applied to clinical and basic research.
There are three areas where there are unresolved questions. Now, one of which is maybe one of the areas that was very difficult, but where we did find literature support was in terms of symptoms. So when is a symptom significant? I mentioned that already.
Yes.
For the moment, we're saying that a symptom is significant whether it's bothersome. And that's actually become a very useful term. But I think that may change with time. We may get more accurate definitions, better, as Marie mentioned earlier, better correlations between outcome measures, objective outcome measures and symptoms. The second area that was, I wouldn't say contentious, but certainly involved a lot of debate is the whole issue of, can somebody who actually has a GI disease ever have gut health?
Right.
What we came down on is saying that if they're in complete remission, as best as we can measure it right now, we can say that they can't have gut health at that time. Now, again, that may be subject to revision in the future because somebody may say, okay, insane inflammatory bowel disease, okay, the colonoscopy is normal, the biopsies are normal, the calprotectin is normal, all the blood work is normal. But, you know, a few years down the road, somebody comes out with some other marker and says that, well, it's not really actually completely in remission because we're detecting an upregulation of these genes involved in inflammation. So that's an area where we may have to be revised in the future. And the third area we stayed away from is one actually you touched on earlier, and that's the issue of risk. So we did not get into the whole idea of, okay, you're perfectly healthy at the moment, but you have a gene that confers a risk for inflammatory bowel disease or whatever it is. Can you really say that you've got health? And I think because we don't have a lot of longitudinal studies in a lot of areas, we really made a conscious decision. And we mentioned that specifically in the paper, to stay away from risk in people who are currently healthy.
Yes. Yeah. So you pointed out that, you know, a person could have a GI disease or disorder, but there can still be a concept of health that applies to them. You've also made a distinction in the paper about transient symptoms. You know, if somebody has a bout of diarrhea or constipation, and how that's different in what it means to something that has more long-lasting impacts on quality of life, for example.
Yeah, I can. That area actually was not as tricky as we first thought, because there has been quite a lot of work done on this area recently. And for the most part, we have limits for duration of, say, acute diarrhea, short transient constipation. They're a little bit vague, fuzzy at the edges, but we do have an idea of what's a short-term illness versus a chronic one. But again, it all comes down to this whole issue of, is it causing trouble for you? Is it interfering with your daily life? Is it interfering with your work, being able to go to school, you know, your normal relations, etc.? And, you know, fortunately, the Rome Foundation in particular has done a lot of work on this over the years in relation to common symptoms like constipation or dyspepsia, etc., etc. So we had something to fall back on there. I'm not saying that they're perfect, but at least we had some, there was a database that we could turn to.
Maria, can you talk to us about how you think this might, the having a consensus definition will impact scientific progress going forward?
Yeah, and I'll just start from the angle of diet and dietary studies. And so that's another important component of our paper, and that's the determinants of gut health. And diet is obviously deeply connected to our gastrointestinal function, and that includes food groups, individual compounds in foods like fibers, dietary patterns. And where we're looking in, you know, we look at the literature in gut health, the scientific literature, this is where we find it used most frequently by dietitians, nutritionists, as ways to describe the health of our gastrointestinal tract. So gut health. So like I mentioned at the start of our conversation, in that what we could envision is that when describing or planning a clinical study, to say a priori, this is the domain or this is the aspect of gut health that we are addressing.
Okay.
So that we can better perform like follow-up analyses, like meta-analyses across studies that will, I think, certainly improve the field. And you know, we don't expect this to be the last definition or discussion on this topic. So yeah. We hope to see it continue to evolve.
Well, there's one domain that we haven't covered yet, but it's the biggest. In many ways, it's one of the biggest, and it's relevant for both of our guests. So that's metabolism. Maria, I think of you because of the sauerkraut studies. You know, we might find a particular metabolite is what's doing the magic.
Oh, well, there's definitely a connection with the gut microbiome and how our gut microbes provide us with energy depending on what we eat. But I think what we're also looking at here is endocrine function, looking back at the domain of epithelial barrier. We have immune cells, but we also have other cells in the epithelium called enteroendocrine cells that are vital for producing hormones, so gut hormones like GLP-1, among others, that I think show us directly how important the gastrointestinal tract is to our overall metabolism, our overall health. We're thinking a lot about GLP-1 receptor agonists these days. So this is certainly a central theme in our domain in gut health. And I'm going to turn the mic over to Eamon, who's thought a lot about this and written on this as well.
Yeah, so I think it's actually a nice theme to wrap up on, because I think the endocrine responses tie in a lot of this. As you mentioned, gut microbes involved, it ties in physiology. And of course, it's terribly relevant at the moment because of all the issues in GLP-1, et cetera. So I think this is like the limitation of this area is in metrics. You know, we do not as yet have readily available, well-validated metrics to assess the metabolic or endocrine components of gut function. Yes, you can measure hormones, but as was pointed out in the paper, there are some significant methodological issues with measuring these hormones, exactly how you do them, et cetera, et cetera. So that is an area that, you know, in theory, you would imagine we should be able to evaluate and assess fairly readily, but in fact, it's actually quite challenging. But it is an integrating function and one that we need to be very aware of. And hopefully, as Mir just said, it's something we will address in the future and hopefully have more definitive outcomes for you.
Yeah, measurement's key. I mean, there's even things we can measure, but we don't necessarily know what's the normal range.
Exactly.
So I think this paper is going to really, it's going to really help research moving forward. I anticipate, like most of the ISAP consensus definition papers, it's going to be hugely cited. And so I really want to express my appreciation to Maria and Eamon for leading this effort. And I recommend all of our listeners get a hold of this paper when it comes out and read it.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, Please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions, or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.